I'm Tracy Sable. Tonight on EWTN News Nightly, ready to retaliate. Iran dismisses the latest round of diplomatic efforts to resolve its conflict with Israel. How the White House is responding. X marks the spot. Former President Donald Trump talks with Elon Musk for 2 hours on social media. Look up in the sky. We examine a highly anticipated celestial show and its ties to a Catholic saint. Plus, a feel-good story. For the first time in 4 years, an important part of the shrine at Lourdes is fully reopened to the faithful. These stories and more tonight.
From EWTN, the Global Catholic Network, this is EWTN News Nightly.
Thank you for being with us on the Feast of St. Maximus. Our top story tonight, President Joe Biden defends his rhetoric against former President Donald Trump and indicates that he will attend the inauguration even if Trump wins. Biden's responses come directly in response to EWTN's questions today. Correspondent Owen Jensen caught up with the president just outside of the White House. Owen.
Good evening to you, Tracy. That's right. As President Joe Biden was leaving the White House today, headed towards Marine One, I shouted a couple of questions to him regarding former President Donald Trump. Here's that interaction.
Mr. President, if Trump wins, will you attend his inauguration, sir, for the peaceful transfer of power? If Trump wins, thank you, sir, for coming over.
If Trump wins, will you attend his inauguration?
I have good manners, not like him.
And also, sir, you call him a genuine danger to American security, but you've asked for the political rhetoric to be tamped down and be cooled down. Is that cooling down the rhetoric?
That's just a statement. That's a factual statement.
Also tonight, President Biden says he is not giving up on a ceasefire deal in the Middle East. The Biden administration has been trying to keep the war between Israel and Hamas from expanding, all this as the U.S. and the world continue to await what Iran will do or not do.
As President Joe Biden flew off to New Orleans to promote his moonshot initiative aimed at reducing cancer deaths, at the State Department, continuing calls for de-escalation in the Middle East. While Iran weighs possible retaliation against Israel, diplomats seek more peace talks.
Prime Minister Netanyahu confirmed that his team will be at the ceasefire talks on Thursday.
Iran rejected a call by three European countries urging it to refrain from any retaliatory attacks that would further escalate regional tensions. But Iran calls it an excessive request.
No one benefits from any kind of retaliation. And what we've been engaged on is intensive diplomacy with allies and partners who are helping us communicate that message to the region.
With Israel bracing for possible retaliation by Iran, the Pentagon has been beefing up its military presence in the region. Today, this update.
So look, our focus is on de-escalating the situation. We have put these additional capabilities into the region to enable us, as I highlighted, to protect our forces, but also to support the defense of Israel should it be attacked.
Meanwhile, in central Gaza, newborn twins and their mother killed in a bombardment. Their father waiting to pick up the birth certificates when he found out. And today in Russia, Vladimir Putin hosting Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas. Putin saying, quote, "We are watching the humanitarian catastrophe unfolding in Palestine with great pain and concern." Abbas in turn thanked Putin for Russia's support.
Also today, the Iran-backed Houthis are suspected of attacking an oil tanker in the Red Sea. A bomb-carrying drone boat was used in the assault. The Houthis have targeted more than 70 vessels since the start of the war in Gaza. At the White House, Owen Jensen, EWTN News Nightly.
And joining us now is Robert Murr, professor of international affairs at Syracuse University and a retired Navy intelligence officer. Professor Murr, great to have you back on. As we just heard from Owen, the U.S. has bolstered its military presence in the Middle East, including with naval assets in the Persian Gulf, the Red Sea, and the Mediterranean. Do you think this show of force will act as a deterrent for Tehran?
Yeah, Tracy, great question. I think it will. I think, you know, the overall purpose of having those additional forces, the USS Georgia speeding up the Lincoln Battle Group and to add to the USS Theodore Roosevelt, which is already over there, and all the land-based aircraft and additional assets we have throughout the region. As you just heard, the idea is deterrence and hopefully to de-escalate matters. But it's just prudent with all the different points of pressure that we've got throughout the Middle East to have a strong presence there and to upgrade it a little bit.
Yeah, and many had expected Iran to attack Israel last week, and now we're hearing this could happen in a matter of days. What type of response do you think that we could anticipate from Iran if it happens, and why do you think it hasn't happened sooner?
The Iranians have a lot of options. I think, you know, the question is whether they do something directly against Israel or something indirect with all the proxies that they have. You know, we just talked about the Houthis down in Yemen and the activity they're taking in the Red Sea, but also, you know, Hezbollah, Hamas, because of the additional activity that's taking place in Gaza and elsewhere, and also all the proxies they have in Iraq and Syria, which can conduct operations against the U.S. forces that are on the ground there as part of Operation Inherent Resolve. So the Iranians have a lot of options. I think they're probably having a vigorous discussion inside their own councils in terms of how they want to do it. And my sense is the fact that they haven't responded already is because they have a disagreement internally about how they want to do whatever happens next.
Yeah, Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant recently said that Iran and Hezbollah are threatening to harm Israel in a way they have not done in the past. What do you think he means by that?
I think he is probably alluding to the fact that they want to do something different. You know, the large-scale attack that they had about 2 months ago was very unsuccessful in spite of all the different kind of platforms, cruise missiles, ballistic missiles, and unmanned aircraft that they try to launch against Israel directly. So they're probably looking at some other option that will be perhaps more successful than what they tried the last time, to include the surrogates that we mentioned earlier.
And if Iran does attack Israel, how do you think the U.S. will respond? How do you think they should respond?
We have to be very careful about what we do in the region, and it's you know, it can be frustrating, but we have to do a very tough balancing act to deter action by the Iranians as much as possible in terms of some kind of response, in concert with our other allies in the region, all the Gulf states, the Jordanians, for example, and others that we have to look after. So it'll have to be very measured and hopefully de-escalatory, which is the overall goal of any response that we might have.
Yeah, absolutely. We know Iran essentially rejected Europe's urging to call off the attack. We also know that Cardinal Pietro Parolin talked to Iran's president on Monday regarding the situation. Do you think it's possible that his appeal on behalf of the Holy See to avoid a more serious and widening conflict will have an impact? And do you think that cooler heads will prevail?
I would hope so. And you know, we communicate with the Iranians, too, directly and indirectly. We have a lot of ways to pass messages to the Iranians. I think people would be surprised how often we're able to engage with them directly or indirectly. And the overall message that I'm confident we're giving them now is to ask them to exercise restraint, because the Iranians, they don't want to have a conflagration in the Middle East, and they do want to respond to some of the recent attacks that have taken place, especially the one that took place inside Tehran. But I'm sure we're communicating with them and letting them know that we hope they de-escalate. And we're probably doing so in very strong terms.
Professor Murray, I quickly want to ask you this about our troops over there in the region. We have, I guess, roughly 45,000 men and women stationed over there at various bases throughout the region. What of them? What are the concerns there?
See, just, you know, the force protection posture that they have, whether they're ashore or at sea, it has to be heightened just based upon where we are now. We need to have a strong footprint in the region as a deterrent, or else things could really get out of control if we didn't have those forces that are stationed over there. We also, as you know, have to look after them very carefully, whether they're in you know, the Gulf states, in Iraq, and at sea in the Red Sea or the Eastern Mediterranean or the Gulf of Oman and so forth. They're scattered pretty widely, but they're looked after very carefully, and I'm confident that they're going to execute their missions very effectively and act as a continued deterrent.
Yeah, we hope that happens for sure. Praying for it. Professor Murat, great to be with you as always. Thank you so much for your insights. God bless.
Good to chat with you, Tracy. Good day.
Our Russian military officials insist that they have stopped a cross-border incursion, but Ukrainian officials say the advance is ongoing.
We are achieving relevant results in the Kursk region. We'll continue doing what is needed for the security and defense of Ukraine. And also, it needs to be stated that the operation in the Kursk region is helping the front, because it enables Russia to transfer its troops to the Donetsk region and makes its military logistics difficult.
Well, that statement as evacuations are underway in Russia's border regions. The Ukrainians claim the cross-border operation was not intended to take control of the Kursk region, but to protect its people. Former President Donald Trump returned to social media platform X, the place where he largely built his political brand and changed the way that presidents communicate. Last night, he was interviewed by owner and supporter Elon Musk and said they had, quote, a friendly conversation.
What I can tell you is this. We cannot have a Democrat. We cannot have her. She's incompetent. She's as bad as Biden in a different...
Yeah.
Look, she hasn't done an interview since this whole scam started.
During the two-hour chat viewed by millions, Trump also referred to rival Kamala Harris as a San Francisco liberal. In turn, Harris' campaign called them self-obsessed guys, adding that Trump and his team are in service of people like Elon Musk. During their talk, Trump and Musk also discussed immigration, the environment, and the economy. Well, two more states are set to feature a measure in November to enshrine abortion in their constitutions. Abortion advocates in Missouri and Arizona reached more than enough signatures to ensure the measures would appear on the ballot. Both proposals would guarantee a right to abortion in the respective states. Arizona currently bans abortion after 15 weeks of pregnancy. Missouri has a near total ban. Well, the first battle lines have been drawn in what is likely to be a messy election year government shutdown fight. It may complicate House Speaker Mike Johnson's job to keep government offices open past the September 30th deadline. Capitol Hill correspondent Eric Rosales joins us now with more on that story. Eric.
Good evening, Tracy. The conservative House Freedom Caucus is signaling that it will not help Congress avoid a government shutdown next month unless a continuing resolution is linked with a measure requiring proof of citizenship in order to register to vote. It's called the SAVE Act, and it's designed to keep illegal migrants from voting in federal elections.
I think we should attach it to a continuing resolution bill when we come back in September. I think we ought to jam it right down the throats of Democrats, make them go explain to the American people why they don't want to keep government funded and ensure that only Americans vote in American elections.
Freedom Caucus member Congressman Ralph Norman tells me the link between the SAVE Act and government funding is essential, and a line in the sand must be drawn.
By this, you know, one, I guess, caveat to the getting the 12 appropriation bills passed and to spending, we've got to have that.
The SAVE Act passed the Republican-led House in July with five Democrats signing on as well. Another Freedom Caucus member, Georgia Congressman Andrew Clyde, posted on X, quote, any short-term spending bill must include the SAVE Act. It's imperative that we prevent illegals from voting in our elections before it's too late. But Democrats say voting by undocumented migrants is already illegal, rare, and not an issue.
This is pushing the alarm button for something that is really not there. I don't know of any undocumented person that will go and try to vote and try to get themselves arrested and deported.
Congressman Norman tells me he hopes House Speaker Mike Johnson will go along with the idea.
So this should not even be a question. I mean, why is this even a question in America? To not have safe elections or to run the risk of letting those who are not residents of this country and not citizens of this country is an atrocity.
The Freedom Caucus is also calling for a continuing resolution to extend until March of next year, hoping that former President Donald Trump will be in the White House again. That puts the group at odds with other GOP colleagues. On Monday, House Speaker Mike Johnson called on Senate leader Chuck Schumer to bring up the SAVE Act, but he stopped short of endorsing the idea of making its passage a continuing to keep the government open. This is just the beginning of a spending fight that could come down to the wire. It's important to note that a shutdown has never happened in an election year. At the Capitol, Eric Rosales, EWTN News Nightly.
On the National Hurricane Center reports, Tropical Storm Ernesto is strengthening as it slams the North Caribbean. It is taking aim at Puerto Rico, and it could be at or near hurricane strength by tomorrow morning. Rain totals of 6 to 8 inches with maximum amounts of 10 inches are expected across the U.S. territory. In anticipation of the storm, schools there are now closed and shelters are open. And we have a lot more still to come here on EWTN News Nightly, including escalating gang violence. Haiti is now the country with the largest number of displaced people. We have analysis. And a major wildfire that swept through a city in Greece. We have the latest on that. new report from the New York Times finds gang violence in Haiti continues despite new leadership and an influx of international security forces.
There is no tactical or strategic value for the gangs taking over this. This is really just about, you know, completely discrediting the state.
Reports say that Haiti's gangs are shifting their attacks and influence outside of the capital, Port-au-Prince, to areas with beleaguered police forces and less security. According to the United Nations, gang violence this year has displaced nearly 580,000 people. That is double the amount from 2022. And during the first quarter of this year, 2,500 people, including at least 82 children, were killed or injured, making it the most violent quarter since 2022. All right, with more on the situation in Haiti is Stephan Destin, the Director General of Proche Haiti, an organization set up by the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops to rebuild the church in that country. Stephan, good to have you back on. First, can you tell us about these attacks outside of Port-au-Prince and other areas? Why are the gangs shifting focus there?
One thing I should say is, like, the gangs are shifting focus towards, like, the Route National number 8, which is just an extension of the existing territory that they already occupy. Due to the fact that after the arrival of the Kenyan forces, that they saw that there was not any, there were not many action or many attribution to tackle them down. After a few weeks of observation, they started getting comfortable, and then they started moving and expanding their territories towards the area of Gantier, which is right on top of the Road National Number 8, which takes you straight to the Dominican Republic, which has been a road that's been quite with many issues as far as, like, for the buses and travels to go back and forth from Port-au-Prince to the Dominican Republic. So it's quite a lucrative area when it comes to the traffic volume that they would have as far as, like, goods going back and forth from the Dominican Republic to Port-au-Prince.
And it's such a tragic situation all around for people there living in fear of the gangs. I know there's also a report the gangs attacked a school for children who are hearing and sight impaired. Apparently, about 40 gang members, they looted the school and also threatened to shoot the children. What does this say about the depravity of these organizations?
The situation has been very difficult for these many organizations that have been doing so much good work in those remote areas. And having the gangs attacking them, it's been very difficult for them to work, and finding also people that are able to go in those areas and help and volunteer or do the work that they need to do. This school is it's been there for years. It formed so many generations of folks with that are blind and deaf and stuff like that, and they've been able to find a certain position and certain work. Or even, like, find a way to live with the situation in Haiti, which has not been easy for handicapped folks to live. But they've been able to form them, go to school, and just be normal citizens. But that situation has been a dire thing, where it shows, like, the no mercy that those gangs definitely show to the folks that are really in need and to the folks that are doing good also.
Yeah, and it's scary for everyone, especially the most vulnerable over there. We're almost out of time, about a minute left or so. But tell us about the new prime minister. He immediately came in and replaced the police chief, I understand, when he took office. Have there been any positive impacts from his leadership so far? What have you seen?
One thing that I can say is that the choice of the new police chief has been puzzling to me, because he's a police chief that has been there before, and was replaced by Jovenel Moïse, and coming back with him right now has been very puzzling to me personally. As far as, like, the results on the ground and stuff like that, we have not seen any tangible results which would change the mind of the general public as far as saying something is moving in the right direction.
Stephan, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us about all this. We're praying for you, praying for Haiti. God bless you.
Bless you too. Thank you.
The city of Athens is recovering after a deadly wildfire that triggered multiple evacuations. So far, at least one person has died in the fire that swept through the city's northern suburbs. Swirling winds had hampered the efforts to put out the blaze, which reportedly damaged dozens of homes and businesses. Satellite images show around 21,000 acres of land destroyed by the fire. Up next on EWTN News Nightly, Celestial Show. Learn more about a highly anticipated meteor showers that go until the end of the month. Plus, nothing better than a healing bath. We have details of a big reopening in Lourdes. You're wondering, there's still a couple of weeks left to see one of the most anticipated meteor showers of the year. The dazzling display is known as the Perseid. Beautiful streams of light and color travel across the sky amid explosions of fireballs. The celestial show is visible every year from mid-July to September 1st. The Perseid peaked over the weekend. What's more, it also has a connection to a Catholic saint. All right, for more now, we turn to Chris Graney, astronomer and historian of science with the Vatican Observatory. Chris, great to have you back on. So tell us a little bit more about the meteor shower and its discovery back in the 19th century.
So the first thing to know about the meteor shower for EWTN viewers is that they are traditionally known as the Tears of St. Lawrence, because the Feast of St. Lawrence is on August the 10th, and the meteor shower comes, you know, starting about then and going out onward. Meteors were originally, for most of history, thought to be an atmospheric phenomenon like rainbows and things like that. And it was sort of average Catholic faithful in France who began realizing that they came regularly on this feast. And so they interpreted them as the fiery tears of St. Lawrence, who was martyred by being cooked alive and supposedly had the cheek to comment to his torturers that, well, you're cooking me unevenly. I have to be rolled over and done to be for a nice even cook.
Well, as we mentioned, you know, the meteor shower is going to be visible for the next couple of weeks. Chris, what are some of the best places to view it, and why should people make an effort to see it?
Well, the best places to view it are someplace where it's dark, and the best time to view it is after midnight. This is because the meteors have, you know, they're not atmospheric phenomena like rainbow. They are the fact that the Earth colliding with a stream of little bits of debris from a comet, and the side of the Earth that's facing forward into the motion into the comet is the side that's after midnight, when you rotate around that far into the Earth's path. Why you would, so that means that you have to be kind of committed to really want to get out in the dark, you know, after midnight. They're pretty if you see them. There's not a lot. They're fun to talk about, and for the person who wants to go do that, they will be rewarded with some pretty meteors that not everybody gets to see. But no one should go out expecting to see some sort of fireworks display. This is for a person who's out to see these meteors and to make that connection with the Tears of St. Lawrence, so yeah, to speak.
It is an incredible story. And what other stories or other things are you following in the heavens that we should be aware of?
Well, it's worth noting that there's a group of researchers at the VO who studies, in a sense, things connected with meteor showers. Well, there's a couple. There's one guy who studies meteor showers directly, and there's another person who study small objects in the solar system, which include asteroids, comets, things called trans-Neptunian objects. And meteors come from these small bodies and are small bodies themselves. They're not tears, and they're not like rainbows. They're little bits of the solar system that collide with Earth, and they're moving fast enough. They heat up in the atmosphere to make the atmosphere glow.
Well, Chris, always a fascinating conversation with you. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us, and we'll continue to look up towards the heavens. Thanks so much. God bless.
All right. Always glad to talk to EWTN.
All right, finally tonight, for the first time in 4 years, the immersion pools at the Shrine of Our Lady of Lourdes are fully reopened. The move comes ahead of this week's pilgrimage for the Assumption of the Blessed Virgin. More than 30,000 pilgrims are expected in Lourdes. The immersion pools have been closed since 2020, first because of the pandemic and then for renovations. The president of the pilgrimage called the reopening, quote, a return to normal. Now we thank you for watching tonight. Remember, you can follow us on social media, Facebook, X, and Instagram at EWTN News Nightly. I'm Tracy Sable. Good night, and God bless.